Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation and the beautiful and very interesting day I had with a number of discussions. So looking forward to this colloquium and to the rest of the meetings I have. So what I'll be doing is, this is kind of a merging of my couple of lives that I had, because even though for a while I was resisting to doing again hydrodynamics after doing biology, at a certain point I realized that there was some interesting problems where in fact hydrodynamics and physics get merged with biology in a very natural way. So I had to overcome my resistance to get back to hydrodynamics and actually get what you will see, which combines the two. And in particular, as you will see, physics plays a very important role in these two phenomena, very natural phenomena that are observed on insects and birds. So I'll be trying to give an overview of both, starting with the problem of olfactory searches, which is on the left, and then moving on to the right. And then I'll move to the second problem, which is the problem of how birds soar in thermals. Both of these problems, they have technological application, in particular for robotics, because both of them, people would like to build robots that perform the same function as the animals. And one of the big problems is that building robots is not the issue, is more how the robots should be controlled. And this calls for some methods and some modeling, as you will see. So let me get started and present you the phenomenology of what I want to discuss, which is olfactory searches by insects. So what's the observation? The observation is that you have, this is a male moth, and you can distinguish male moths from female moths because the male moths, they have these antennae which are completely covered by receptors for pheromones. And the source of pheromones is a female. The females are sitting on the trees and they emit pheromones. Usually these pheromones are a mixture of different molecules. These different molecules, they are emitted on the order, there's a few picograms per second. So it's a relatively minute concentration of molecules which are sent out from the trees into the atmosphere, and they get transported by the wind and the atmospheric turbulence. So that's why turbulence is going to become important, because that's the wind and atmospheric turbulence is what transports this molecule into the environment. Now, the typical weight, this sentence here, few hundred Daltons is not important. What is important is that this number means that these pheromones, they are not sinking in the air, so they can get transported for tens and even hundreds of meters without getting to the ground. So this is something you have in the air at heights of a few meters, which is where the male moths are flying. You have this concentration of pheromones, and what these male moths do with this little scent and trace of pheromones is that they do something astonishing. They start tens or even hundreds of meters away. As you can see from this scale, these are tens of meters, but there are observations of this being done hundreds of meters away. They detect a few molecules, and then they get into this various stereotype pattern that you see here that entomologists have classified two phases in these patterns. One phase, which is called zigzag, the arrows are the local direction of wind. So zigzag is when the moths are consistently moving upwind, as you see here. And this is qualitatively associated with phase where there's enough detections of these pheromones. As you will see in a second, this concentration can be very sporadic. And then there are phases where most probably it's because they don't detect anything anymore, they cut the wind perpendicular to the wind, or they can even go downwind. And by alternating these two kind of patterns, they manage to get to the source in timescales of the order of a few minutes. Okay? So not only they get to the source, but they get to the source in timescales which are very rapid. Why is it surprising and why is it so difficult? The reason why it is so difficult is that, in fact, the signal is extremely small and extremely tiny. And the reason why the signal is extremely tiny and sporadic is that these molecules, which are already in a relatively tiny concentration, they get transported by turbulence, by atmospheric turbulence. Now, if you look at what turbulence generates, turbulence, contrary to molecular diffusion, is not smoothing out the fields. If you look at what this is a typical turbulent flow. If this is on a table, this is the typical distance that you're seeing here. So there's a jet which is coming out. There's water which is coming out of here. And then there's a second tube which is made of this fluorescent dye. And as you can see, this is far from being regular. It's something which is extremely convoluted, which creates many gradients. And if you go 50 meters from the source, this is what the signal of concentration is going to look like. So it's made of peaky and very intermittent signal. From time to time, you get a few spikes. But the rest of the time, actually, the concentration is extremely low. And this is what turbulence, and this is what a turbulent signal is generating, naturally because of the nonlinearity in the process of the velocity field. So you shouldn't imagine a smooth field which is diffusing, like in the case of bacterial chemotaxis. The signal these animals have to process is something like more like a few spikes from time to time, and then the desert for quite a long time. And they have somehow to integrate these few spikes, to put this all together, and to figure out how to integrate this signal in such a way as to get to the source. Now, the fact that the signal is sporadic, you can have a quantitative sense from this picture here, where what my collaborator and friend Emmanuel Villarmont in Marseille did was to take this flow here and to measure the fraction of space you sit at a given location, and you measure the fraction of time that the concentration is above a certain threshold. So here, UT is essentially the distance from the source, downwind. D is the size of the tube, just to make it non-dimensional. CS is the threshold concentration that you fix. So you detect something just when it's above a certain threshold, that in the case of MOTS, you should imagine is the sensitivity of the receptor. And then C0 is the level at the injection of the source. So this is essentially what's the probability that as a function of the distance, I'm going to detect something. And as you can see, this is falling off very rapidly. And actually, you can proceed with this curve, and this gives this kind of signals once you get to 100 meters. So to give another evidence of this, this might be an image of a signal when you have very high concentration, and mostly this is transported by the wind, and there's by a constant wind, and there's just a little bit of diffusion which is going on. And this one is when the wind is a little bit convoluted, but there's still mostly a large-scale wind without any turbulence. So as you can see here, this is essentially a tube. And what the animal should do here is mostly localize the tube where it is. And once it's in the tube, it can essentially climb to the source. If you go up the concentration in a field like this, you're going to make it to the source. Same thing here, there's a little bit more work to be done, because once in the source, you cannot quite go straight. You have to follow this convoluted path. But still, you can climb gradients and get to the source. These are problems that are called plume tracking, essentially because you have to, or path tracking. The reality of the problem, though, is quite different, and it's not this. It's more something like this. If you look at the typical snapshot of the level of concentration, you're going to have a few plumes, like here. This is 100 meters. But you also have distances of the order of tens of meters where the signal is essentially absent. And somehow, the animals or the robots have to go through this jump from one to the other and get guided and integrate the signal that they've got and make it to the source. Now, some of you might be familiar with the so-called mean models. You might think, wait, but this is a snapshot. What the thing I can do is that you're showing me snapshots of the field, but what I can do is that I can integrate over time. So I sit at a certain location, I wait long enough, and then gradients must appear, and then I can climb over these gradients. This is true. The only problem is the time scales. The time scales that it takes for the mean signal to appear and for gradients to appear are tenths of minutes. Okay? That's the time scale that it takes because fluctuations are very strong. So people have devised model for the mean concentration. They're pretty famous. There's, for example, Sutton's model. And these models have been used in situations like, for example, you have a chimney or you have a radioactive source, and you want to know what's the spreading of this radioactive source over time. So in that case, you're not interested over tiny fluctuations or fluctuations over short time scales. What you want to know is whether if you have a chimney which is emitting here, on average, what you're going to get like 10 kilometers or at a distance from the chimney. So in that case, the mean concentration is the relevant object that you want to look at, and people have developed number of models for this kind of things. But insects are not sensitive to the mean. Insects, they respond on timescales of the order of 100 milliseconds, fraction of a second. And over those timescales, there's absolutely no averaging which is going on, and you essentially have to rely on the snapshots. Okay? So this is, and there are experiments showing this. This is an experiment done by Mafraneto and Cardet, where they changed the pattern of stimulation at timescales of the order of 10 or 100 milliseconds by having pulses of different duration. And as you can see, the behavior is totally different. So the animals are sensitive to tiny fluctuations on very fast timescales. So to make the summary of this slide, average models are relevant for other problems, but certainly not for the case of olfactory searches. So we have to deal with the fluctuations. And in addition to insects, this problem is relevant, as I was mentioning, for technology. Because what you would like to do is that, imagine there's a chemical leak somewhere, you would like to have a robot which is able to localize the source of a chemical leak or a toxic leak in order to get to the source and do what is needed to fix the chemical leak. Now, this is a prototype. They're called sniffers for obvious reasons. So you can have a camera. That's not essential in case you can have a camera. Then there's a processor, so you can do calculations. And can move, of course. And then there's what are called electronic noses. So this is the part which is sensitive to the molecules that you want to detect. You can sense the concentration of these molecules that you want to detect. The receptors are not, the e-noses are not as sensitive even by far compared to the insects, both in terms of sensitivity and response times. So you will see what we are going to do once we get to the experiments that we have to do. We'll actually use sensors for temperature rather than concentration because of these limitations. But the main problem that I would like to discuss, and that's what we've been working on, is imagine you have a good receptor. So imagine that these sniffers were equipped with a good receptor that comparable to the one that moths and insects have. How should you control your robot? So I give you a trace of concentration along the way that you've seen is made of peaks. How should I, in response to this signal, how should the robot move in response to this? So if you want, it's a problem of control and decision theory. How should I respond to this trace that you've seen before? How should the robot move in order to get to the source? Okay? And let's forget for a while about the biology, and let's assume that we treat really the case of robots. So what we've done is the following, and what I would like to discuss is to discuss the strategy of search that we introduced together with Emmanuel Viermo and Boris Schreiman. And we called it infotaxis for reasons that, for the following reason. Taxis means oriented motion, and typically people are familiar with chemotaxis, which is motion which is driven by chemical gradients. In our case, chemical gradients, as you've seen, they don't exist. So we have to replace chemical gradients with something else. And this something else, as you will see, is information. So what we're going to do is that rather than relying on gradients of chemical concentration, we are going to rely on gradients of information acquisition. And this is what the reason why this name, in addition to the fact that a fancy name like this gets you into Nature rather than publishing in other journals. And this is what the kind of pattern that you get, which is, as you can see, is quite similar to this one. So let me describe what this is. The robot is starting, or the agent is starting from here. It has one detection. The wind is blowing this way. And the gray level is proportional to the probability of detecting something. And of course, there's a cone of higher probability here. And there's very little probability of detecting anything if you're on the side of the source and the wind is blowing this way. These black dots are detection of something. So we're supposing that the agent can detect the concentration when it's above a certain threshold. So it's starting from here. It detected something, so it's going upwind. But then for a long time, as you see here, it's not detecting anything. So it starts wandering around in a way which is very reminiscent of this casting, cutting the wind perpendicular, even going downwind, as you can see here. And then here it's going to get another detection, so it's going to move upwind, and then it's going to start casting again, and then finally it gets very much into the cone and is able to get to the source. So how this is achieved? Let me describe this a little bit more in more detail. So this is achieved, as I said, the idea is to use information, because what the problem is that at the beginning you don't know where the source is located, and at the end, you know exactly where the source is located. So we can look at this problem somehow from the point of view of information theory. After all, what this process is about is that there's a female sitting on a tree, and there's a male 100 meters away, and somehow they are communicating. They're sending a message to each other via these chemicals, and they are trying to communicate in a cable which is very far from being effective because it's a very noisy cable, but that's probably the only thing they have. So they communicate, they're sending a message. So let's treat this problem as a problem in communication, and the same way that Shannon in information theory treated the problem of sending a message through a cable. And so we can consider this trace here of detection and non-detection along the trajectory of the searcher as a message which has been sent to the searcher. And our problem is to decode this message and decode it in such a way as to figure out what's the unknown being the location of the source. Okay? So we're going to treat this as a problem of information theory, where what we do is that we build a map of where the source might be located, the probability map of the location of the source, as a function of the message, which is this history of detections and non-detections. And just to give you a sense of what the map looks like, so what you're going to do is that if you detect something like here, you have a certain probability of where a model of the environment or where the source might be located if I detect something. Let's say there's, for example, the wind is blowing this way, I'm going to have a higher probability into a cone which is coming downwind. So this could be an exponential or your models, favorite models of turbulent transport. That's not very important, and it's not that important to get into a model. But what is important is that you start from a situation at the beginning of the search, like this one here, where the probability map of where the source might be located is essentially flat. So as you know, this is the situation of maximum Shannon entropy. So we have the maximum uncertainty on the map of probability. And then we start moving into space. We get a few detections, then we don't get any detection for a long while. And as we progress along the way, this map is getting sharper and sharper and less uncertain until at the very end, we localize the source and the entropy, Shannon entropy, drops to zero. So the idea of the search and infotaxis is to use this idea of minimizing the fact that the limiting factor is the amount of information that we have on the location of the source. And therefore, what we are going to try to do is to move in such a way as to maximize the rate of information acquisition. So I guess the Shannon entropy is the sum of the probability at the given at the various location p log p. So S is going to be minus p log p. This is the Shannon entropy. And then what we do, imagine that you've gone through a certain number of... So let me go back. Suppose that you've been wandering around and doing, you have a few detections like here, and you're sitting at this location here. Now you have to decide whether you're going to move north, south, west, or east. And in order to decide this, what you're going to do is use the information that you've acquired so far, and which is giving you an idea of where the source might be located in terms of probability, to calculate self-consistently how much the Shannon entropy is going to reduce if I move, let's say, north, south, east, or west. Okay? And this is the formula which corresponds to this. So let me walk you through this formula, at least a sketch, an idea of what it is. You're sitting at R, and you're moving... I'm doing this on a grid to simplify things. You move at one of the neighboring locations. A few things can happen. If you jump at the new location, you might find that the source is there. If the source is there, the new entropy is going to be zero because you found the source. There's no uncertainty left. The old value of the entropy was S. So this is the difference in entropy between what you're going to get and what you had before. And this is happening. The best estimate that we can give is to make this self-consistent and to use the estimate for this event that we've been building so far. So this is the probability map at time t for the location of the source to be at rj, which is my new location. Okay? This map is not entirely reliable, so I'm doing this self-consistently. So that's the first term. The second term is that I don't find the source, so the probability is complementary to this, 1 minus pt. And now a few things can happen again. With a certain probability, I don't find I don't have any detection of particles. So I'm going to update my map and calculate the difference between the new Shannon entropy and the old one, which is delta S naught. So this corresponds to the event where there's zero detection of particles. This is one detection of particles, and I can cut this very fast because I take the time step small, so maximum there's going to be one or two detections. Okay? And then once I have this, this can be calculated self-consistently from the existing map. I'm going to get four values, one, let's say in two dimensions, the value going north, going south, going west, and going east. And now I pick the value which is the most negative, because I want to reduce Shannon entropy as rapidly as possible. So I go greedy. Usually in chemotaxis, you go greedy on the gradients of concentration. We go greedy on the gradients of reduction of Shannon entropy. And that's all we do. Okay? Now, for those of you who are familiar with reinforcement learning is a general machine learning methodology. It's a broad class of methods that you use when you have an environment to explore that you don't know. And there's no supervisor which is going to tell you, do this or do that. So it's going to supervise your action. You have to explore with your actions the environment and figure out by yourself, by the reward, whether this is a convenient action or it's not a convenient action. So in all these cases, you're faced with what is called the dilemma between exploration and exploitation. Because at the same time, you want to exploit the information that you've gathered so far because you're trying to maximize something, like, for example, reward, or you're trying to maximize some form of value. But at the same time, you have to explore the actions because nobody's telling you what are the good actions. So if you don't explore, you might be missing some very fruitful and rewarding actions. So there's a balance to be struck between exploitation and exploration. And you can see in our case that what this strategy is doing, it's actually balancing exploitation and exploration. Because this term, if you forget about this other one, forget for a second this one, what this one would be telling you is that you should go to the location of maximum probability. Because this term alone will be maximized, the most negative will be for the maximum PT. So this is telling you, rely on your probability map and go to the location of maximum probability. So this would be a greedy strategy in the probability, very close to something like climbing gradients or climbing probability. But the second term here is balancing this very greedy attitude with other terms that correspond to gathering more information about the location of the source. And so what the strategy does is to balance these two terms and get a combination of the two and choose the minimum of the combination of the two. So it gets into this general class of reinforcement learning algorithms. So just to give you a sense of how it works, this is the PDF of the search time, and as you can see, it's falling off exponentially at large times, so there's no bad events where you lose the robots, for instance. The other thing we did, those that I've shown you before were simulations. We've taken experimental data, put an agent, and it works, even though even when in cases where the model of the environment is not particularly good. Then you can upgrade this strategy. Rather than having a single robot which is searching for a source, you can have a swarm of robots that are searching all together for a source. And in that case, they can communicate via Wi-Fi their detections, building up a map together and collaborating on the finding of the source. And what we get in this case is that the search time can go down with 1 over the number of robots. So this form of collaboration is very effective. And finally, even though the natural case always has wind, you can actually consider the case without any wind. So have a source, and there's no wind. In this case, of course, the problem is harder because you don't break spherical symmetry, so you have to search around also on the angle, let's put it this way. But even in this case, the searcher is getting to the source using a completely different pattern, so it's going around in spirals rather than having the zigzag and casting, but it's still making to the source by using this pattern, this spiral-like patterns. So once you have this algorithm, now you can go and implement on real robots. And this was done by my postdoc at the time in Pasteur, Jean-Baptiste Masson. And let me just show you what he did. So this is a robot like I've shown you before. It's equipped with a sensor of temperature. And you will see momentarily that there's a fan and there's a heater, which is located here. It will appear in a second. So this is the exploration phase where it's going around, casting mostly. And now you will see here it is. So there's the heater, and then there's a fan which is generating kind of a mean wind. And now, as you will see, it's going to cast a little bit more, turn around, and then get finally to the source. And this is what it's doing. It's implementing on the robot. It's been implemented this strategy that I've mentioned here. And we've done other experiments in a wind tunnel, so distances of the order of 20 or 30 meters. Just for term of comparison, before we started doing this, people were employing strategies based on gradient climbing, and the maximum distance they could get to was 2 or 3 meters for the physical reasons that I've told you before. So I think to conclude this robotic part, I would say that, as I stressed, we are looking for temperature source. If you wonder why we use temperature rather than chemicals, it's the reason that I've mentioned you before. So the receptors for chemicals are not that great yet. Great progress is being made, but they are not comparable to the receptors by insects. Temperature probes are much faster and much more sensitive. So that's why we use temperature sensors. And that's why what we've addressed is more the strategy problem, as I tried to explain, how to use a good receptor in order to make the robot get to the source. So this is what I had for the robotic part. Now, of course, the fact that we could build a robot so effective doesn't mean that we've understood what animals do. So very briefly, let me tell you what we are doing, and it's mostly these days that we're doing this. So let me describe what the kind of things that we want to address experiments and modeling that we're doing. So the problem is how animals are deciding when to zigzag, when to cast, what to do, how to control the casting. And there's a number of questions that are fully open and nobody knows the answer. So let me make a little bit of a list. First of all, the big discussion with animals is whether the animals, they react in a purely reactive way on their model-based. So the difference between the two is that imagine that you receive something, then for 3 seconds you don't receive anything, and then you get into a stereotype pattern of, for instance, going back and forth with respect to the wind, which is completely pre-programmed, and there's no control whatsoever of this kind of pattern. So this is what people call in the field, with a slight abuse of language, reactive. And then there are strategies like the one that I've discussed so far, which they call it more cognitive. Cognitive is because it goes through a phase of inference that you're trying with the model of the environment to figure out, to infer, where's the location of the source. So you're trying to learn something about your environment, about parameters of the environment. And nobody knows whether animals are closer to this one or to this one. And there's a number of questions that are fully open, as I was saying. For instance, the entomologists call this casting, but clearly, I mean, this kind of pattern here of casting is not quite the same as this one, or is not quite the same as this one where it's going downwind. So casting, it's a unique name, but in fact, the pattern of casting is more complicated than just going upwind, like in the case of zigzag. So the statistics and the control of the casting is essentially unknown. The other thing that is not known, which is embarrassing to say but is not known, is what's the memory of the past detection. So in order to decide what to do at a certain time, how much does the animal remember of the past? Does it remember 3 seconds, 30 seconds, 3 minutes? This is a number which is not known. Even a ballpark estimate of this number is not known. And then finally, is there a sense of space where detections are made, which is a very hot topic in cognitive neurobiology these days. And in order to address these issues, we are running some experiments together with Michael Dickinson at Caltech. So rather than MOTS, it's more convenient for genetics and for a number of experimental reasons to work with flies, with fruit flies that you find in your kitchen whenever you leave the fruit for too long. And so the first thing we are going to establish is the distance at which the flies are attracted to odors, to typical odors. As I said before, moths, it's established that they can find mates on distances of hundreds of meters. So we would like to have a similar estimate for the case of flies. And there is, in fact, one estimate, which is of the order of 100 meters, which was done by Coyne and collaborators in a few years ago. What they did is that they released the flies at the given location, and then there were traps with odors on the side, and estimating the statistics of the capture of these flies and comparing to a null model where they just don't get attracted by anything, they could estimate that the distance, the attraction range, was of the order of 100 meters. It's a beautiful paper. The only thing which is not quite, we want to just repeat the experiment by making a little bit more controls, because the two trap doors, as you can read here, they were on two sides. One was on the oasis side, and the other one was on the desert side. So in addition to olfaction, there might be additional cues coming from the oasis. So we just want to make sure that it's entirely coming from olfaction and not by some other cues like polarization or habituation to the environment where they were raised. Once we have this estimate, then what can be done is to use tethering experiments. because it's very hard in the wild to go and deliver some concentration and track the concentration and at the same time track the animals while they're moving. This is something which so far nobody is able to do. So it's more convenient to work in the lab, to tether the animals, like here, by a wire in the back, and look at how they respond to well-controlled stimulation. The problem in this is that nobody knows or knew what should be delivered. So what does the trace, what's the statistics of this pattern that I've shown you here? This one here. How can I generate a statistical pattern which resembles this one? What's the statistics of these peaks? How spaced they are, how high they are, and for how long do they last? With this information, we could be able to generate a pattern which is realistic enough. And so that's what we tried to do and what we achieved in this paper here. So what we did, essentially, we calculated the statistics of odor detection downwind of a source, and we have a statistics of the height of the signal, the duration of the signal, and the spacing between these different peaks. And just to give you a sense, I will not get into the details of this, but just to give you a sense, this is the probability distribution of the spacing between two detections, two of these peaks that you've seen before. It turns out that the distribution has a broad range that we predicted to be t^-3/2. And these are experimental data that you can gather in the atmosphere at distances of 60, 230, or 330 meters. So there's a broad range of variation in the times that this blank period, this desert period, lasts. And we have a prediction, so we have an analytical form for this PDF that we're now going to use to stimulate these flies and see how they respond to these different stimuli. Okay, so that's the plan, and we are doing it, so I have no results to tell you so far, but we hope this way we'll be able to have a little bit more quantitative sense, at least on the memory, and if possible, on the strategy that these insects use in order to get to the source. Okay, so let me now get, how much time do I, 10 minutes, okay, good. So very rapidly, on the second part, at least to give you an idea of what's the phenomenon, because it's a really fascinating one, the soaring of birds and gliders. So this is a GPS system, which was, this is a paper by Vicek and collaborators a few years ago, they put a GPS on a falcon, and they track the trajectory of the falcon as a function of time. So this is what you see. Down here is the height of the falcon. Here, what the falcon is doing, as you can see, is taking a spiral motion. And even though you cannot see that, it's gaining height. And it's gaining height because the landscape here, heat is heating the ground. And at some location on the ground, because of hydrodynamic instabilities, actually you start to have convective rolls that start to go up. So you have columns of air. You shouldn't imagine an elevator because it's not quite an elevator because it's full of turbulence and it's full of fluctuations. But on average, you have a column of air which is going up. And what the animals do is that they spiral around the core of this thermal, and they use this to get height. Why is it useful? Because while they are doing this, they don't flap their wings. So they can gain height without flapping wings and saving on the metabolic cost of this process. And this has been used very heavily and very profitably by migratory birds. This is a paper very recent that appeared where they tracked migratory birds close to the Seychelles, as you can see here. They tracked the path of these migratory birds, and they track the height of these migratory birds as a function of time. And the astonishing result which was found is that actually these birds are able to fly order of 200-300 kilometers per day by using thermals that are located in this region here. And this is a plot of the height of these animals as a function of time. As you can see, they fly at a few hundred meters. And then from time to time, they get very high. They can get even beyond the clouds. And they have a few of this. And then what they do is that they get high, they get to 2,000 meters, and they glide down to the next one. Then they take the next thermal, they take height again, and they slide this way. And that's the way they can save energy, and they can go much faster in their migration. And the fact that this is important is also proved by the fact that if you look at migratory routes, they're usually very dense in these thermals. Like in the previous case, it's an absolutely stunning phenomenon. It's very important to understand if you're curious about these kind of things, but it's also very important technologically because you might want to use this on autonomous flying vehicles, which are vehicles that have an engine, that have a battery, but they can also, they can use the engine, but of course you would extend the autonomy of the flying vehicles if you could save on the engine and just fly like these birds do, or the gliders. Now, to give you a sense of how good the birds are, if you ask a glider, there's a glider port very close to UCSD, so the first thing we did was to go and ask gliders, so how do you fly? How do you fly into a thermal? And their answer was, we look at birds, okay? So they're certainly very good. Some of these glider pilots, they also say that then some birds look at them. I don't know if I have to trust them or they're making that. Anyway, so that's the quality of what the birds are able to do. So like in the case of insects, we decided that we should try first to devise something that works for artificial systems, and then go emit some hypotheses on how this could be done so that we can go and test something quantitative on the real animals and the real phenomena. So what we did was to take a very simple modeling of the situation in the atmosphere to model this as a Rayleigh-Benard convection fluid. So we have the ground, which is kept at a certain temperature, which is higher. This is temperature. The temperature on the ground is higher than the temperature at the top. So this is going to induce some convective rolls, as you can see here. And you can also see that this is far from being a column very regular of air because it's full of fluctuations. And so what we do now is that we put an agent into this, a flying agent into this flow. A flying agent is a typical, it can be a glider, like without motor. So we apply the classical laws of aerodynamics. The flying can control the angle of attack, which is how much is tilted with respect to the horizontal. The banking angle is the angle that they control with the wings. And the yaw is this direction here that they can control. And these graphs are the classical aerodynamics curves that tell you how much you sink if you go at a certain angle of attack. How much is the horizontal velocity and the vertical velocity? So these are classical curves that apply more or less uniformly to anything which is flying in the air. Okay? So we take some of these curves, so we constrain the motion of the glider, and then we put this glider into the flows that we are generating numerically, and we ask the agent to learn to gain height into this thermal. So it should figure out how should respond to these mechanical cues that it's sensing. It could be temperature, it could be velocity, it could be acceleration. How should it use these mechanical cues in order to gain height? And I'm going to go fast on this part of learning, but we essentially use standard tools of reinforcement learning. Again, this is the book that I mentioned before on reinforcement learning. So the idea, just these are the formulas I can discuss if you're interested more later. But the main idea is the following. What these methods wants to get to, it's a policy. The policy is I'm in a given state. A given state, it means I have a certain angle of attack, a certain banking angle, and a certain yaw. I detect a few sensory motor cues, which could be the acceleration. which could be the torque on the two wings of my glider, what action should I take? Should I increase the bank angle? Should I reduce the bank angle? Should I increase the angle of attack? So this is what this system wants to get to. And just to give you a sense, these tools have been employed, for instance, to learn how to play chess, how to play Go. Go was recently the machine beat a champion, the Korean champion. It was using a tool which was very similar to this method here, SARSA, that we've been using. And they've been trained to learn this action. So first question, what should the glider sense? And to make a long story short, in the interest of time, we conclude that the two cues that are the most efficient in order to gain height are vertical acceleration and torque. So vertical acceleration, and then torque is the difference between the acceleration on the two wings. Once you have this, then now you can go and use these two cues in order to gain height. And to give you a sense of how it works, this is at the beginning of the training. So the starting period, the starting point is higher than the end point. So actually the glider is sinking rather than going up. And this is what you get at the end of the training, which is represented here. So you see a few tenths of training meaning exposure to these fields, you gain height several hundred meters in time scales of the order of a few minutes. And as you can see, there's a spiral very similar to what birds get. Okay? So let me skip the policy. What we are doing right now is, but the policy is what you imagine, what you should do, how you should change the bank angle as a function of the cues. So what we are doing now is like in the other case, in the previous case, we are testing this in the wild by taking a glider, which is represented here. We go at in location where there are thermals. That's the beauty of San Diego. You don't have much of a problem in heating the ground. And so you have plenty of thermals that you can use. And then programming the glider in such a way as to implement the strategy that I've discussed before. And this is what you get in terms of the height in time scale of a few minutes. And this is the trajectory in one of our experiments. And what we are doing right now is to try and beat existing strategies of flight. In particular, there's one famous strategy in the field, which is called after Mr. Reichmann, who was a three-world champion of these glider competitions. You cannot imagine, they spend their weekends flying with these gliders. So Mr. Reichmann was three-world champion, and he has a strategy, a policy of flight, that gets some height, as you can see here. So we are comparing right now the policy that we presented with the policy of Reichmann. So far, it seems that this one is outperforming Reichmann 1, but we need more statistics. So we are in the process of doing this. And with this, I can conclude. And thank you. Yes.
So, as a former glider pilot, when actually, certainly the acceleration issue is a hefty torque, very important in terms of identifying the core.
Yes.
How much detail do you go into in terms of the structure of the turbulence? The turbulence themselves are relatively relatively small radius, typically.
Right. So we don't put any information on the turbulence. We have no model. Okay, there's no model of turbulence in this. This is learned from experience. That's what reinforcement learning methods do. They learn entirely from experience. There's no model which is put in. So in practice, the only limitation is that if your glider is too small, the torque is going to be extremely noisy. So the longer is the glider, the better it is, because the difference is going to be more reliable. Which, by the way, is also known if you have birds for reasons that have to do with the lift. A very small bird cannot soar. You have a minimal wingspan, which is of the order of 1 meter, 1 meter and a half, which is needed in order for a bird to soar. So that's the only limitation that we have. Except for that, then it's quite general. Yes. Right. That's a great question. I'd like to know the answer. What I would like to know is, in particular, whether or not, how long does it take for a bird, newborn, to learn to fly? So there's several hypotheses. One is that they learn entirely by experience. The other thing is that they could use the information which is coming from their parents. So I don't know whether the birds are being taught by parents, because that's a pretty convenient way of speeding up the learning. So they could just be taught by their parents how a few rules or a few other things. This could certainly speed up. So it wouldn't be completely blank slate in that case.
I have a little baby robin that I rescued because it crashed into the
air. Oh, good.
And uh-huh. They learned how to fly without his parents, and I didn't teach it. So.
Yes. So they could probably do it, but you don't know how long it takes in the presence of the parents. What I would like to know is, how long does it take, for instance, if you're supervised or you're not supervised? I'm pretty sure they can do it even without the parents, but does it take longer or does it take a shorter time? This is something that would require some controlled experiments, and as far as I know, there's no data on this. Yes. Fly. Yes. Purely of soaring, as far as I know, no. But these birds, they actually use soaring most of the time. But purely soaring, not that I know. Well, the other thing is that they don't exist anymore, so it's easier to make stories about them. So I don't know whether they couldn't find at all or they're more similar to this, but yes, I've heard this. And they couldn't fly, I know. But you might know that Lord Rayleigh was not quite an idiot. He said that engines couldn't fly last century, a century and a half ago. His prediction was that you cannot make a plane. So I kind of not trust completely these extrapolations, but it would be interesting to try and do it. Yes. I didn't explain the model. Actually, we are using directional cues as well, because we are measuring the local direction of wind, which is very similar to what moths do, because they can measure the direction of wind. So that's the way we go upwind when something is coming, because we know the local direction of wind. Okay. So it's much more similar to moths. We're using directional cues as well. And that's why when you detect something, you go upwind, because it makes sense, right? The higher probability is coming downwind. So we are using directional cues as well.
Is there any sense in which your first strategy is optimal?
So it's probably optimal when you're very far away. It's certainly not optimal when you get close to the source. So I can certainly cook up another strategy where, rather than doing just this, So rather than doing this, I find it less elegant, but can certainly be done. I combine these two terms, which are a little bit like energy and entropy. I balance them with the temperature so that I work with the free energy, and then I put the parameter here, which is controlling the balance. Now, if I tweak this parameter, I can go faster than this. Okay? So it's certainly not optimal. On the other hand, what I can see is that it's not optimal when you get close to the source. If you're very far away and you ask the question, how long does it take to go from very far away to a distance which is, let's say, 50 meters from the source, I cannot beat so far this one. The difficulty in doing analytics with this case is that you change the statistics of the detections. So your actions are going to affect the statistics of detections. There's another problem that we've worked on, which is called multi-arm bandits. It's the case where you have a bunch of slot machines that you don't know what's the probability of winning. In that case, we can show that the strategy of acquisition of information is optimal. But for this one, we cannot, except for these empirical statements, but it's certainly not optimal in the most general sense. Which one? This olfactory searches? So we've tried changing the local direction of wind. You can treat that. It takes a little bit longer, but you know, if the wind is not completely rotating by 180 degrees, it's just going to take a little bit longer. It's not a major issue. Sorry?
You're talking about ants, you should ask Neil Wilson about
Yes, that's a good answer, thank you. But so I'm not going to be as good as Wilson, but so we've looked at moths, we've looked at flies. As you notice, the case, I think, of ants and even mice, in fact, it's probably slightly different because the detections are going to have quite a different statistics. So there's been a work in the case of mice where I might have a slide actually. No, I don't. Here it is. Yes. Here. So the case of rodents, what they've done is that they've taken a very small arena, half a meter by half a meter. They've put some sources of odors, which are the green and the dots, which are here. And they've looked at how the rodent is getting to the source. Now, from what I told you, half a meter, it's relatively small distance. So actually what they discovered is that at least at those distances, the way the rodents move is consistent with gradient climbing, which I don't find particularly shocking because it's just half a meter. So what happens to mice over distances of 10 meters? It's a completely open problem. Nobody really knows exactly what they do. And for the other animals as well, it's an open... I don't think there's any... The only case where I think people have made the... are pretty much well... establish how they do it is lobsters. So lobsters have two antennae. They sense a trail because, again, they are at a relatively small distances. So what they do is that they sense the last side of the two antennae where they got the detection. So whenever they got out of the trail, from this information, they cast back into the trail, and this way they're able to make it to the source. That's pretty well established, but that's pretty much the only case where I think, even in the case of animals, it's well established.
you use a purely machine learning
yes.
approach. So just curious, why not a model? Because we have a good reasonable model for turbulence. Would it not improve the number of trials?
Yes, for sure. Yes. We didn't want to put too much because we have no sense about the memory of these animals. So again, like in the case of insects, in that case I was much less confident. In the case of the, we put a model in the together with Boris. We put a model because in that case we really had, we were really doubting whether moths could do that. So in that case, the question of how animals do it was kind of secondary, totally secondary to us. And then in that, so, but we've been blamed, of course, by the fact that they keep telling us that the memory is infinite. It doesn't really matter because it works with the short-term memory. So when we started doing this, I kind of started from the other side. I cut on the memory. I used a very simple signal that we can, of course, complexify as much as we want. So it could be done by putting a model, but we just started from the other side because somehow we have in mind that we want to get to birds. It's a sociological more than scientific reason.